BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music documentaries, telling the stories in music that matter.
First met Dr. King at his church in Montgomery, Alabama.
From Mavis Staples.
When we did the first Smiths record, Morrissey and I had that in common. We got into the girl groups through the New York Dolls and through Patti Smith.
To the Smiths and St. Vincent.
It's such a heavy record. It felt like the closest thing to a religious experience.
Updated daily on BBC Sounds. Now, this is a BBC Radio 6 Music documentary.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. My guest this week is probably the most controversial figure in rock music of his generation. Born Brian Warner in 1969 in Ohio to strict religious parents, he evolved into a singer and performer vilified by the media as a corrupt, blasphemous and degenerate influence on the youth of America, something he'd happily admit to. My guest this week is Marilyn Manson. Here, Marilyn talks about his earliest musical passions, how he rebelled against his constrictive religious education and created the character of Marilyn Manson for a fake article while a teenage music journalist. He also remembers his steps to fame and his experiences in the wake of the huge success of his 1996 album Antichrist Superstar, which sold some 7 million copies. And never one shy of confronting his reputation, Manson also recalls his first arrest and details his experiences as a hate figure for the US media. He also talks frankly about how his music was reported by some as the motivation behind the tragic Columbine High School massacre in 1999. And for someone dubbed the Antichrist superstar, he was friendly, philosophical, thoughtful, and actually quite funny. But I started by asking Marilyn, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
I believe it was either Creedence Clearwater Revival, Suzy Q, or it was Neil Diamond or Elvis Presley. I'm sure it was an amalgamation. The first three records that I actually identified with were Xanadu.
Olivia Newton-John.
The White Album and Kiss Alive 1, I believe. But those records, because they were just in the car that my mother drove me to school in, because my mother didn't want me to go to the bus stop because I had a fair share of ass beatings. I got my ass kicked the old-fashioned way.
Those are all, in their own way,
strange.
Very interesting records. I mean, the White Album still sounds strange.
Also, the White Album was the year I was born, 69, when it was the Summer of Love ended with Altamont and Sympathy for the Devil, first album to be blamed for violence, White Album, Charles Manson Murders. I believe the Life magazine with Charles Manson on the cover of it was probably in the waiting room when I was born.
Really?
So, yeah, probably. I'm assuming it would be because it was the same time. So it's just really odd that I think 1969 was the year that the world really changed in so many different ways. Kennedy being shot, color television being invented the week before by the people who created the bullets that killed Kennedy. Maybe it's fate, maybe it's coincidence, maybe it's America. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide.
Yes. What about the first music that you owned? That's a different relationship you had.
That is different. I think one of the first records that I purchased, and this comes with the burden of explaining, when I was in Christian school, there was the honor system, which meant no locks on the lockers. And a lot of the other kids were not allowed to go to the record store. So I became a bit of a pimp hustler, where I would buy records for $5 or whatever they were at the time. It's about age 13. And I would sell them to these kids that were my classmates, but I didn't like them, for about $20. Then I would wait till later that day and I'd steal them out of their lockers. And they could not tell on me because there was the honor system. So that's when I first discovered that. Later, I went on to sell my mother's diet pills, which were also like technically speed. But that was in public school to try to blend in with the crowd. I remember, I think Motley Crue, Shout the Devil, I think was probably the first record I sold and stole back from someone in Christian school. Obviously appropriate. Maybe I was trying to be a pacifist in some ways. I was trying to save a problem for these young, innocent Christian minds, selling them records, taking them back.
Selling them again.
Selling them back again.
First gig. What was the first gig that made an impact?
I think it was seeing, not when I was, it was one of the first ones I went to. I think it was the one that meant a lot to me. It was probably seeing Ministry and Killing Joke in Miami, Land of Rape and Honey era. I thought the record player was broken when I put that album on. I was, I didn't understand that. Stigmata. I didn't understand it at first, which I love. I love things that are not easily understood. I think confusion and chaos is what I'm meant to do, because that's the catalyst for any sort of change or any sort of something interesting. People always mistook it for shocking or trying to be controversial, but I like to be that musically. I like to be the stick in the spokes, essentially. You know, the problem, at least the thing that you should maybe have thought to not remember to look for when you were going about what you were doing. That was probably a triple negative, but I wanted to do that for you.
Call the first band that you were, the first proper band, how would you describe it?
Well, I've only had one band. I was a journalist. I was age 19, and I went to Broward Community College, took journalism and theater, dropped out after 3 months when I lied my way into doing my first cover story, and it contained an article with Marilyn Manson, interviewed by Brian Warner, and I had no songs, so I had to create the songs to fill in the void of the Frankenstein I created. You know, and then I tried to make it a band, but I think Twiggy, my bass player, who was in the band, then was out of the band, and is back in the band again, we wrote Beautiful People together at a Holiday Inn, I think, while I was riding on his back, and a four-track player duct taped to my chest or something of that nature, and just, because I used to play drums in Christian school, but I was demoted to triangle player when I moved to public school.
That's a big demotion.
I think maybe early on I realized drummer, singer, I'm gonna go with singer. Drummer's usually on the lower echelon of like the if you went Dante's Inferno upside down, you'd be like the...
But it was very much about concept first, band second.
Well, concept first, music soundtrack to the concept. And then my love of music started to form itself with trying to find people that would be able to wrap their head around whatever it is that my ideas are. But I would never like when people say, I don't care what other people think. I specifically care what people think. I'm not controlled by it, though. I want people to think what I'm trying to say. But I want them to choose for themselves what it's going to be, because I'm just amused by the different interpretations of it. Or maybe it's because I want it to be something that's become something of its own entropy. I'm not really sure what it's going to be, but I also don't like the misconception of thinking, I don't want to look like I'm trying too hard.
Talk about David Bowie.
Ashes to Ashes is the first video I saw on MTV. It was probably when MTV actually, first time I turned it on, it was one of the very first videos they ever showed.
Was that one of those moments for you, that kind of Brody on the beach? There it is.
Yeah, I may love it still for nostalgic reasons, but I think that record has still remained one of my favorites. Yeah, it's beautiful. But my favorite Bowie record is Diamond Dogs, which was strangely, and I've read the compilation Enemy put together of the old Bowie articles, and I was reading them going to myself, this sounds like they're talking about me. They even made Alice Cooper cracks at him, thinking to myself, wow, this is really, I can't believe that someone who came to America, who created Ziggy Stardust simply by, in the same way that I said, I'm famous when I wasn't, and thus it became true. But you have to have a lot of swagger.
Yeah.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
I want to ask you, first time you were arrested.
Oh, I remember quite clearly. I was arrested for indecent exposure in Jacksonville, same place as Jim Morrison.
What happened?
They thought I was masturbating with a dildo on stage, and I was simply wearing rubber underwear that had a penis-like place in it, but I was,
a penis-like place? It makes it sound like a house.
It had, a place to...
Put ones,
it was ones. Shaped in the form of a man's body made of latex. And I had that on stage, and even in the tradition of Michael Jackson, sometimes someone may be flirting about, fancy pantsing around, dancing. Point being, I was lucky enough to get off stage and remove those underwear before the sting operation, because it was a setup. They really were waiting for me.
Really?
So it was a religious group that sort of set the whole thing up, but I changed it to regular underwear. Did not get the chance to remove my leather pants or this lipstick from my face, so that was not a great look going to jail. I was like, hey, so I was thrown into a room that was as small as a bathroom. Here it was a bathroom. It had a toilet and a sink actually combined together, and a very large green mile sized black gentleman. He couldn't even fit through the door. Threw some dishwashing detergent. It's pink.
Yeah.
He threw it to me and he said, wash your face. So I had to wash my face with pink dish detergent in a toilet. And then he came in after that, about 2 or 3 minutes later, he said, now where's the dildo? And I was a smart ass. I'm like, why you want a dildo? And then bam, broke my jaw. My jaw is still broken from it. I mean, it's still forever tormented by it. That's what happens when you sass off. So I went there, and I was only there for about 24 hours, but it was a lesson well learned. I did not get bothered by anybody else in jail, though. Actually, what happened was, at the time, I had a lip ring, very 90s of me, and they pulled it out with pliers. They said, we're going to pull this out now because it'll get ripped out in Gen Pop by someone when they beat your ass. I was like, well, that's good to know. I wasn't sure if I was scared or not. I was not really, it was very surreal to me at the time. But then I ended up, because when they book you and they do all this process, I ended up getting in the psych ward, obviously. They were asking me these odd questions, and I answered exactly what I knew that they didn't want the answers to be. So I would end up being in the psych ward, and they gave me this smock, and it was sort of a pale green, and a hospital thing, which was assless, of course. But fortunately, I was left alone to my own devices. And when I got out, I kept the hospital smock of Jacksonville Penitentiary or jail. And I kept that, and I wore that on stage the next night when I got out. I wore it with a G-string and combat boots, and that's where it started.
Yeah.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, Marilyn Manson. And that was Manson's cover of Depeche Mode's Personal Jesus from 2004.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time on 6 Music, the show where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career, and that song was Beautiful People, the first big breakthrough hit by Marilyn Manson, my guest on this week's show. The idea of subverting sexual norms is something that frequently surfaces both in Manson's lyrics and the imagery he creates for himself and for his videos and cover art. In his autobiography, he explains his first exposure to sex was in the family basement, where his grandfather kept a huge collection of pornography.
My father told me that he wasn't a collector of pornography, he was actually a dealer. And I said, Dad, my book would have been so much better if you would have told me that sooner. And he said, well, write a new one. That was my dad's response.
I guess the first equivalent question would be, when did you first kind of come into contact with something that would be considered to be unconventional?
My first erection was achieved whilst watching Scooby-Doo and Daphne, the red-haired girl in the purple dress. That was my first erection. I swear, that's true. Daphne was flirting about in a purple skirt with her obviously high on narcotic friends, seeing ghosts, having the munchies, Scooby-Doo, guys talking to dogs. Fred wearing an ascot, obviously gay, you know, so I felt like, in my mind as a youngster, probably age 10, now that's a woman I need to grow up to have sexual intercourse with someday, but not knowing that sentence, but time traveling back, I would have said that to myself.
Scooby-Dooby-Dooby, here are you, you're ready.
So with Antichrist Superstar, that was the kind of record that first really, it really brought you into the mainstream. I mean, I'm really interested as to how...
That's quite a surprise, actually.
How that would feel, because you weren't looking for it.
I was looking for trouble, obviously, 100%. But I guess trouble's what was needed. You know, I think the world wanted trouble. It was all complicatedly strange because I released Sweet Dreams
first
while recording Antichrist Superstar. So while I was recording Antichrist Superstar, I got to see the effect of Sweet Dreams, which was the first buzz clip, I think, on MTV. It was all odd to me because in New Orleans, there were no boundaries or ideas or there was no way of understanding the social impact of it in New Orleans. I'd go to the studio and we did a remarkable amount of narcotics, but I was not allowed to say that, nor am I now. It was, for me, it was a growing up period where I had to say to myself, you know what, I don't need this. And I just, at some point, I completely realized that I don't want to live this life where you live in a town where if you see a pretty girl, she's either going to the airport or coming from it. It's a miserable place to live sometimes. And for me, it was. It's a nice place to visit. But I've also said that about myself. I'm a nice place to visit, but I would not want to live here. And I grew up in Ohio. I think that in places where there's a lack of, I suppose, education or culture in the way that I'm accustomed to now, it does breed some sort of magnet towards religion. And that's, I suppose, where Antichrist Superstar came from, just the fact that I grew up, I had to memorize all the Bible. I know more about the Bible than most preachers or Christians of any sort. But, you know, knowledge does not determine destiny. My IQ is 170. Doesn't mean I'm going to use it for something worthwhile. I drink it down to 150 sometimes just to communicate with normal human beings. But I think that's it, right above Mozart. No offense, Mozart, if you're listening.
See, this is the thing, looking at a lot of the footage of that time, it was almost as if they were waiting for you. The right and the religious extremists and the moral harbingers were almost looking for someone like you, and they enjoyed it. And they almost didn't want you to be eloquent. They almost didn't want you. They almost didn't want to hear your arguments. It's quite funny.
Well, I think that you looked at it the same way I did at the same time, because I just saw this void of somebody calling bullshit on them, but not saying it in a way that they would understand. It's like when you're at a strip bar or something, which I have a 5-minute rule. When you walk into a strip bar, within 5 minutes, I'll play a Marilyn Manson song. Even if I'm not known to be there, if I wore disguise, they're not capable of arguing with somebody who has rational thought. I've found in every circumstance when I've tried to argue with, or not try to argue, just try to simply have a conversation with someone religious, because they always fall back on the simple thing. Well, it says in the Bible. The best thing about the Bible is it's thick enough to hit someone in the head with.
So the other thing, aside from that, was missing the humor. And I don't actually mean the humor in the imagery or the humor in the music, but
sardonic.
Yeah, I mean, there was, what's the quote? You were saying something about, yeah, you know, the Beatles said they were bigger than Jesus, I'm bigger than Satan. It's
Thank
a
you.
Funny line.
There's no way to misinterpret what I do. There's just different ways to interpret it. That's why I felt almost drawn to and nearly considering being an expatriate of America when I came to Europe and to England. And there was a point where Johnny Depp and I were, when he was living in south of France, and it was Y2K, and we were both talking about, like, what's the point? But then we, I think we discussed this over Quaaludes or Absinthe or something. But the main point was that we decided that the point of staying American was to be the reason that it makes it either amusing or worthwhile. In some ways, we save America by being troublemakers, which is really amusingly backwards. As much as I dislike so much of America's idiocy and the idea that they can't sell my record at Walmart, but they can sell guns, it really makes, in the same way you said that there was a hole, a void that I needed to fill. If I didn't live in America, what would be the point? You guys would just forget the continent. You just, I think that I'm a necessary evil in America.
Only America could have created it.
They made it. Deal with it.
Your first acting role was Lost Highway.
I did not get SAG, though, because I didn't speak in it. It was just
a now, face. Marilyn, listen, you're going to be naked, covered in blood, you're going to fall down. Why? Doesn't matter. Action.
That was my experience with David Lynch. I actually remember showing him the cover of Antichrist Superstar and asked him if he liked it.
Marilyn, fantastic. Fantastic.
He's always been sweet to me. He's always been great.
And that's a good impression as well. I like that.
But what is really odd is that Wild at Heart's my favorite Lynch movie, so I'm not, the movie that I'm in and my two songs are in their entirety and nearly is not my favorite David Lynch movie. So that, I don't know if that proves I'm not as narcissistic as people might think, or it just proves that Wild at Heart's my favorite movie.
Well, Bebop Lula, she's my baby. Bebop Lula, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Lula, she's my baby. Bebop Lula, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Lula, she's my baby. I'm a baby, I'm a baby, I'm a baby. Well, she's the gal in the red blue jeans. She's the queen of all the teams. She's the woman that I know. She's the woman that loves me so. Say, Bebop Lula, she's my baby. Bebop Lula, I don't mind my baby. Bebop Lula, she's my baby, my baby, my baby. That's right. She's the one with the flying feet. She's the one that walks around the store. She's the one that yells more, more, more. Bebop Lula, she's my baby. Bebop Lula, I don't mind my baby. Bebop Lula, she's my baby. My baby, my baby. Let's rock again now.
The Rolling Stones on your list of artists that you love, straight ahead rock and roll band. What is it with the Stones? When did you first fall in love with them?
Or is Let It, just- it Bleed, and I lived in a house where they recorded Let It Bleed, some of it. Rolling Stones mystifies me in the sense that the vocals are never really as loud as other bands on the mixes of the old songs. And the music, it follows a rhythm and blues, a simple idea. But yet, it's not so simple. But the way it just comes together is completely and utterly mystifying, the magic of it. And that is why it is so perfect. If you took apart the pieces and tried to explain how they fit together and made the ends to the mean, you could never explain it because it doesn't make any sense. But yet, when you hear the songs, it's there. It's beautiful.
Let's go.
European Awards when I performed Rock Is Dead. And I didn't realize that in Ireland it was probably a bad idea to have a burning cross of televisions and be painted entirely black in a cowboy hat. The entire audience turned their backs on me. I've never seen such a phenomenon. They never showed it on MTV, you'll never see it, which I was thrilled by. So afterwards, Iggy Pop was doing a show, and I was standing with Mick Jagger watching Iggy Pop play, and I felt like he had a bit of, like, maybe jealousy or something, like, man, that guy, he's really nailing it. And then someone came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, Iggy wants you to sit on stage, TBI. And I was suddenly, thank God, it's the one song I know the words to the most. Even though you know the words to it, but it's almost like a karaoke scenario where you think you know the words until you get on stage. And I felt like a small sense of pride.
I'd ask you how you first felt when your name was associated with Columbine, because you've spoken so eloquently about it in the past, but I want to know that first reaction of, like, oh, so
I saw it coming because I was watching it in Chicago live on television. I said,
how does that feel?
Well, I had a t-shirt in my mouth and I probably was nailed to the ceiling on drugs like a bat, probably, I don't know, but I was watching it and they said they're wearing Marilyn Manson costumes. Five kids wearing Marilyn Manson costumes. The story started to change, but the very first reports, and I have all the original ones, and the story changed so drastically. And that's my most disappointing part about Bowling for Columbine, is that the entire actual facts were never investigated. Because
what do you mean?
The financing of what it would take to put the amount of weaponry, utterly impossible without someone else involved. It was almost $1 million worth of artillery, and they found, I think, 90 propane tanks around the school. So these kids couldn't have done it on their own, two guys. But they seem so casual when they're going through there. And the one kid had on a t-shirt that was a white shirt, not even a black trench coat. It said natural selection on it. I don't think these kids had any fear whatsoever that they were going to be killed. They were completely in control of the situation. And somehow suddenly it was 45 minutes of a SWAT team and the ATF and all this. Coincidentally, in Denver, Colorado, where the one son's father worked for Lockheed Martin, who manufactures weapons. And he was the first one to call in. I think my son is a part of this. This is true. I'm not going to go conspiracy theory on you. I'm just saying these are the facts. So I'm sitting there going, all right. This is, I didn't know that at the time, but I thought it was too predictably, completely, utterly impossible that it could be how the news reported it, and that they had me being the poster for the whole event. I immediately decided I was not going to partake in doing interviews about it, so I was getting calls from everyone. So there's nothing I'm going to say to talk my way out of this. It's not my fight to win, but if I just contribute to it, it's just going to spiral into more of it. And this was not a care for humanity. This was just simply, I didn't feel like dealing with what the very principle and the idea of Marilyn Manson stands for, making criminals into heroes. They put them on the cover of Time magazine. It's exactly what they wanted. So America created this culture of violence, and they're surprised suddenly that this happens, whether it was a conspiracy or cover-up or whatever it was, or if it happened to coincidentally be the same day that all the bombs were dropped on Baghdad. Whatever. These are all just the facts. I just don't know why things happened the way they did. No one will ever know why it happened that way, but I don't regret it. It was a terrible time in my life. I had my career pulled out from under my feet. Rock is Dead was on the Matrix soundtrack, which unfortunately had Keanu Reeves in a trench coat shooting people. You know, it's no one's fault. I think that the world is smarter, yet still as unable to accept the difference between reality and not reality. And I don't mean fiction and nonfiction, as in television, movies, books, and real life, which is where I live. I like to live in a fantasy world where movies and reality are the same. God is in the TV.
Pale Emperor, I like what you said about living between the real and the fiction in this kind of space. Does this album lie here, or are you more fantasy or more real in this record?
It's hard to say. I think that's a very interesting question that I have not asked myself. I think that I'm enjoying life. I'm not a tortured artist. My brain's always firing in all directions, and I'm often thinking about images while I'm singing about them. And I'm often having conversations. I can hear a conversation going on over here, talking to someone else, and me trying to write a song at the same time. But that also then leaves you open to the fact that people don't understand, if you're that sensitive, that you can be so angry or so gentle. So it's opened up raw nerves, you know. It's almost like having someone with their skin peeled off and every nerve is exposed. So it does have its drawbacks in the sense that I don't do good at parties and I'm not very well in large amounts of people, which is completely insane, thinking that that's what I do as my job, that I love doing, singing to people.
What's the final song we should play?
I think my favorite song that I would like to play off my new record would be Odds of Even. I knew that when I wrote it, it was the end of the record.
Why?
Because I'd gone to in the studio and I heard coyotes, which are very rampant in the hills of Hollywood. They were ganging up and attacking another smaller animal, obviously. But I didn't know that. I just heard like them barking and howling. So I started recording it with my phone. Then it occurred to me that that was sort of the summation of the record, that you may challenge the world, you may go through all this, ups and downs, you may find a partner in a Bonnie and Clyde true romance sense. but we all die alone, essentially. And I was literally hearing a animal being ganged up on and dying.
Are you the hyenas attacking the animal, or are you the animal being attacked?
I prefer to be an observer at this point, a commenter, a journalist, or someone who is beneath that sort of pagan violence.
It's been good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Speak to you.
Thank you. is BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.